you do the, then we will come back to you, Marsha Armstrong. Adrian Garialdi, please.
For this opportunity to give the board and the public a little update on the Shasta River efforts in relation to the Fall Chinook Run this year. As you know, over the past 20 years, the Shasta Valley RCD, in conjunction with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, landowners, and others, have been doing a number of projects on the Shasta River: fencing, fish screens. We've upgraded diversions to allow for fish passage. We now have a multi-year program to address irrigation management and reduce tailwater inputs. And we also have staff working with landowners in the valley to prepare ranch plans to better help address their water quality issues. So now, as a result of a couple of years of having 6,000 fall chinook spawners returning to the Shasta system and heightened efforts in priority area one with fencing and irrigation management, we saw a huge production of juvenile salmonids. So this year, the forecast was for a huge Chinook run on the Klamath system, and we got together and decided that we better strategize, and if that actually happened, we could see this huge number of Chinook salmon coming back to the Shasta River. So we had some meetings with Fish and Game and NOAA fisheries representatives, landowners. We identified some triggers. We were going to be prepared that if we saw large fish numbers, if flows were low and the weather temperatures were hot, we needed to be prepared. So Fish and Game felt that by September 15th, the Shasta River could be seeing the height of its run. And we thought we should probably start looking at our flows about the 10th of the month. With landowner cooperation, the irrigation entities, we were able to secure voluntary water inputs to start ramping flows up. Fish started entering the Shasta system right after the 1st of September, and by about the 20th of the month, we were seeing 1,500 a day coming into the river.
Wow.
So my last count was from September 28th, which was last Friday. We had over 15,000 fish. Numbers had reduced a little bit. We were seeing 1,000 a day coming in, so I'm sure we're right up at the 20,000 range at this point. So I really wanted to recognize the effort of the community and the irrigation entities to provide flows this fall. We were able to protect the fish in the canyon. The fish move into the river, but they don't necessarily move up the river until they're ready. So they actually weren't really being seen until a week ago up in the higher portions of the river. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Thank you to you and your agency for all your hard work along the way. I very much appreciate it. Grace Bennett, you indicated item number 3 or 4. Would you like to go now?
Yes.
Grace Bennett, I'm supervisor for Siskiyou County, and I'm the board chair this year. I have lived in the Klamath Basin for all of my life. My family came in the 1850s. I would like to thank you for recognizing the work that our RCDs and our farmers and ranchers have done to improve water quality. You always talk about clear, clean water and where it's going to come from. We have some clear, clean water, but the water that comes to us from Oregon is not. That affects the Klamath River. That affects how much water is needed to dilute that water as it goes through Siskiyou County. It's very, very important. This year, in your talking about warmth, temperature, sediment, you should understand that we have had 78 days without rain this year. Our temperatures have been in the 90s to 107, 110. So our rivers are warm. They go through flat areas throughout the valleys, and they get warm. And there's no way that we as people, as human beings, can make those creeks and rivers any warmer are any colder than they are naturally. It's very, very important. You talk about fencing the rivers and planting willows. When the willows freeze in the fall, the rivers come up a foot and a half, just from the amount of water that the trees and the river and the willows use along the banks of the rivers. In the wintertime, when we have floods, the fences are ripped out, the willows are gone too, most of the willows. So those things have to be taken into consideration in what is involved in developing riparian areas and how those are worked throughout the basin and in our valleys. We can work really, really hard and do the best we can, but when nature comes along, we have no control. So I thank you very much.
Grace, thank you very much. Thank you also to the Board of Supervisors of Siskiyou County with your support of Rick Casales and your work in the watershed. Crystal Bowman.
Good morning, afternoon. My name is Crystal Bowman for the record, and I'm the Water Resources Coordinator for the Karuk Tribe. And my comments today are focused on the Scott River TMDL waiver, conditional waiver. So first I wanted to say that...
Actually, can I interrupt you?
So sure.
You're on the Scott.
Yes.
Can I stop you then? Because I hate to do this. It's just that I'm trying to keep in order the Shasta, and you actually, that it might be my bad, Crystal. Can I come back to you in a moment,
sure.
Please? I apologize very much. Sorry about that. Rex Casolio?
Yeah, Shasta's three.
Yeah, I apologize, Crystal. Sorry.
Rex Casolio.
I wasn't really intending to speak today, but my name is Rex Casalio. You know, I had prepared a written statement to hand in. Now, realizing that that time has passed, I'll simply read what I can. The following public comments reply to both equally to both orders. Couched in the inference of increased protection, financial assistance, and reduced regulatory targeting, these waivers instead guarantee none of the above, but in fact further a regulatory agenda of increased subjective oppression and unaccountability. Beginning with self-praise for agency action plans categorizing responsible landowners as those cooperating with agency requirements and after proclaiming their own authority, this notice then soft sells fee-based mandates of considerable concern. The notice neglects to address numerous points, a few as follows. North Coast has stated on several numerous occasions their profound lack of specific data and knowledge of causative interactions. When questioned on specifics, they frequently claim lack of knowledge, but when the question regards authority, they claim the claim is the possession of extensive knowledge of best available science. For years, vested long-term experienced residents have recited actual historical conditions and unique and intrinsic effects, such as dissolved oxygen supersaturation, periphyton shading effects, impoundment benefits, and environmentally detrimental riparian shading assumptions, which staff has consistently dismissed. Regulatory impositions imposed upon the people have already resulted in tremendous loss, costs, and even attrition of those people based on locally contradicted agency assumptions. Those actions, ignoring regionally stated knowledge, have resulted in zero attributable numerical improvement. Now, many of those agency assumptions have proven incorrect, resulting in adaptively managed, further imposed landowner burden and attrition, and congratulatory staff job promotions and recognition of advancing regulatory expansion. At no time has the agency ever assumed accountability or consequence for those impositions. Rather than recognizing the need for proven, comprehensive, repeatable knowledge prior to implementation with compensation for publicly approved condemnation of vested property and rights for losses incurred, North Coast instead here endorses even greater unaccountability, subjective, and arbitrarily imposed authority. That response inescapably concludes that primary agency objectives are not the stated environmental enhancement, but instead regulatory authority and regional attrition. To receive waiver protection, the landowner is required to provide whatever requirements are demanded and even give up private property rights to cooperate. None of the knowledge, experience, history, or expertise of the vested landowner suffering the greater confident consequence of failed decisions is given primary consideration in the ability to determine the best, most comprehensive choice. Nor is their devastating mounting financial time and personal loss even addressed as a concern. Rather than concern, the threat is made that the board will increase staff presence to ensure all landowners comply with the TMDL. Under the,
You're pretty close, Rex. It's all right. Well, and I appreciate your statements. You've always been consistent, Rex. Thank you very much. Richard Gurek.
I'm Dr. Richard Gurek, degrees in biology, chemistry, director of Interactive Citizens United, presently science advisor to Siskiyou County Water Users Association. We challenge the authority of the California Water Board and its affiliates to impose any regulatory demands on you waters of the United States. As you all are aware, any waters that are considered navigable fall under the United States Department of Commerce, and not under state control, but under federal control. And today, all three rivers in question here, the Klamath, the Scott, and the Shasta, are considered navigable rivers. Regarding the Klamath River, you understand your TMDL proposals clearly violate the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, Section 7. In Section 7, it states clearly that the water requirements only need to meet the standards at the date of designation in 1981. And then it goes on that the standard evaluation for proposals would unreasonably diminish the stated values. There is no doubt that removal of the Klamath River dams, the release of 20 million cubic yards of toxic sludge, will seriously affect the riparian areas and the flows of the river. Dam removal also violates the Federal Endangered Species Act, as hundreds of indigenous species will be destroyed, including the flyways above the dams today. At one of your own meetings, you openly admit that each dam in place allows for settling of detritus, actually reducing the TMDLs, and yet you propose dam removals. You cannot establish life cycle-based water quality objectives for the main stem Klamath River because the DO concentrations associated with salmonid life cycle requirements cannot be met even under natural conditions. This clearly indicates you are aware that removal of the dams, the Klamath will return to its historical nature, marshes and swamps in a dry summer, and we can probably not expect to see any future fall salmon runs. NOAA, NIMS, and NASA all conclude that the historic rise in Pacific Ocean temperature since 1970 is what caused the migration of coho salmon north into Alaskan cooler waters. The reality is that in 1970, the total catch of coho in the entire Pacific Northwest was 6,200 metric tons. In 2010, it was 15,039 metric tons. There's nothing wrong with the coho population. The other thing that we must realize is that, according to California, Oregon, and Washington, Fish and Game, they indicate that 85% of all salmon spawn within 25 miles of the estuaries. This entire coho program, hundreds of miles away from the estuaries, is arbitrary, capricious, and basically unlawful. I feel that this entire operation for removal of dams is just a political move to go ahead and satisfy some political agenda. Thank you.
Thank you. Felice Pace.
I'll talk on the Scott. I have comments relative to both, but I can talk on the Scott.
If you want to address, Felice, if you want to address issues on the chassis, you need to do it now.
These are general issues.
You got 3 minutes. They're your 3 minutes. You can make your statements.
But then I can't come back on the Scott?
No, you can. You have a speaker card in on both.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
No problem.
My name is Felice Pace, and at this point I'm representing just the North, myself and the North Coast, actually the North Group of the Sierra Club and the Redwood Chapter, where I'm the water chair. I want to start by recognizing the good stewards that we have, and we got several of them in the room here. Most of the people in the room know who they are. There are some outstanding people who were doing the right thing before it was required. There's also some bad actors out there. There's some bad stuff. And that's where we... So I support the staff in wanting to concentrate and make some distinctions there and work with the people that are creating the biggest problems. I have a question for staff that they can answer when they come back up, if they would. You know, progress was talked about, and have we had this question, have we had any actual progress in water quality? We've been operating the waivers for 5 years. You know, we have monitoring. Water quality, not fisheries, is what your responsibility is. And I'd like to know, is there data? Is there actual measured improvement in water quality, in the water quality in the basin plant standards? And that's the proper measure of progress that we must use, because it protects all the beneficial uses. And we're not interested just in fish. We're interested in fish, but we're interested in all the beneficial uses, most of which apply to people, not to animals. So I support the staff approach. I have some concerns about the legal vulnerability of these, both of these waivers. And notification is one thing. If you fail to notify people that they're subject to a waiver that's changed, if you fail to send out a letter to landowners that are subject to these regulations, my concern is that subsequent requests for plans could be and will be successfully challenged in court. You know, if I was a judge and somebody came to me and said, these guys all of a sudden are telling me I have all these requirements and my neighbor doesn't have them, you know, they didn't notify me that I was going to be subject to these. So, you know, I have a concern there that a judge is going to say, yeah, that's reasonable. You know, there's equal protection in the law. So I think we need to address this legal issue of whether, you know, when these subsequent requests of the bad actors or the people that have the biggest problems, happen. What are we going to do? You know, are we going to be legal? Is it going to be subject to challenge, and we're going to have to go back to the drawing board? That calls into question the whole approach. You can stop me anytime because I can do the rest for the other one.
Okay. It just stopped you right there?
It stopped me. Okay. So I'll come back on the Scott, and I have several things. I did want to say to you on the 4 inches, the Forest Service, you know, I've read some of that research too because I'm doing a project on grazing up in the mountains. For the last 3 years, and 4 inches is the standard they use based on review of the literature. And what Brian said was right. If you'd like, I can find that study.
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks, Felice.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I have no other speaker cards related to the Shasta. I would like to move back to bring staff back up and move through the process of taking on the Shasta then. So I would ask Andy to come back up, and Brian, if you would too. I would like to move through the any board discussion to bring back any questions from the board for staff based on comments, written comments, or presentation today. One comment that I would have, Brian, you did a good job at actually, I started to make notes on the sideline here, the where, who, how, when, and type of scenario, and you went through that. You actually presented today more specific detail of the implementation than we've seen to date. I do believe that there is a component, though, at least from the standpoint of notification here of what this program is. I believe these types of plans, as far as asking for ranch management plans, are already an existing program. This simply codifies it to make it so that we're working in specific areas and doing specific work based on some pieces of, or some risk-based approach based on some criteria. I think it would be really, really good to memorialize these for public consumption. We obviously have almost a full house here today, but this is a busy time of year. We don't seem to ever capture everybody in this watershed. And I would ask that staff put together a fact sheet or something similar to that that we could then post on our website. This is all web-based programming at this point, that we could disseminate this information to the landowners and users and workers out on this these watersheds about some of these specific, not only the criteria perhaps, but the approach. I think the approach would be very good to be explicit to the communities of what's expected of them and some of the criteria about how you go about that. I think that would be a very good thing to have. As far as data measurements go, Andy, is it right that there is a monitoring plan that is in development? Do I understand there is a monitoring plan in development that is bigger than what has... I know there's been monitoring done in the Shasta, but that there is a monitoring plan that is at least in initial stages?
Yeah. One of the initial things we've done is we're collecting all the existing data that's already out there and forming a monitoring group. We've got an outline of our monitoring plan, and we're having regular meetings, and then we're going to have eventually have a committee of monitoring experts from the different agencies, landowners, the public, and so forth. RCD, Shasta Valley RCD, is very active already in that.
Good. There was also a brief discussion about the Klamath, some of the work going on the Klamath, and obviously every time that we've come up and talked about, either in workshop form or working and hearing on these watersheds specifically, the Klamath always comes into the equation. There was some discussion about using the Klamath tracking program, I believe. And I know that there's some really good work going on by Clayton Krager, who I see in our audience here, staff person Clayton Krager, in the Klamath main stem. But what I'm also seeing is then the recognition of the importance of obviously these watersheds as being tributary to the Klamath. As far as that goes, can I ask, and maybe it's premature because it is something that is, you guys recognize, you didn't say explicitly that it was something that would apply, but it could perhaps apply. And I guess I'll leave it as an interest that on my part, that if we can continue to connect these watersheds either through something like using an existing program out there that recognizes the importance of these watersheds as tributary to their main stem, I think that's really important.
Yeah, Clayton would be the best to answer questions on KBUMP, the Klamath Monitoring Plan. But one thing I can tell you is we're using the Shasta Watershed as a pilot program in developing a monitoring plan and outreach. And again, we're working with trying to work with everybody doing our outreach, which is, it's kind of in the initial stages. But the Shasta Valley RCD is helping, you know, with our monitoring efforts. And we got a ways to go, but maybe in a year we'll have a good plan together.
The other part is that I know that from the presentation that both you gentlemen put forth here is that, you know, we're not expecting everybody to enroll here. That's not the case anymore. That this new approach actually goes to some specifics, which is great. At the same time, though, that leaves a bit of a void out there for reporting, not from the standpoint of, and I'm thinking in selfish terms to the board, I think it's important for us to be informed. And as this goes, assuming that this is adopted then I would like to request then that we have timely reports, which you've done in the past, but that we continue to do so about the specifics of how these approaches, how this approach works, how you implement this approach, maybe some of the challenges and successes that you encounter out there in the watershed. I think that's very important. And I think it also disseminates information to, because you're talking about working on an individualized basis here with landowners, I think it's also that we are talking about communities here, and I think getting that information out to communities is also important. So, any other comments or questions from board members? Okay. Then I don't have any other speaker cards. It's back to the board. Then I would like to entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, before you do so, I just two comments from your staff counsel, Samantha Olson. Regarding the notice has been sufficiently circulated throughout the watershed, and so your adoption today is what puts landowners on notice. And the requirements to comply with the request from the executive officer will be in place after the vote today.
Okay,
so just for the record, I just want to make sure that you understand that I think our noticing is in compliance with the law. Second, just regarding what you just said about a void in reporting, I think there is not a void in reporting. What you're going to find is better reporting as staff moves forward through the priority areas. One of the slides talked about a documentation of a letter saying you're in compliance, and that's something new in this waiver that is going to track better for us.
Well, and I stand corrected, Council, because I didn't mean to make it seem like somebody was avoiding things. I merely meant that in the past we had expected individual landowners en masse to not only enroll but to report, and that's not the case here. What I would ask is staff becomes somewhat of the reporting mechanism to us as a board so that we know how this program goes. Not for individual landowners per se, but that we need to be informed. I think it's been a healthy dialogue over the last couple of years and over especially the last couple of months with workshops and here today about how we get there and how we move forward in the next 5 years. Recognizing, though, that we're not having every landowner enroll and every landowner be then expected to report to us, I'm, again, in a selfish means asking that this board be informed about your progress as staff and the staff and your experiences out there of the sites that you engage with in some type of formal reporting on a timely manner so that we're informed of how this progress goes. So I stand corrected, and I thank you for that. It's okay. Yes, sir.
We've already drafted an implementation plan, and it's going to include reporting logs of what we're doing and just an overall implementation strategy that Brian talked about. So I think we're going to do all that and update you regularly as we have in the past, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, this is your staff counsel again. I wouldn't characterize that as an implementation plan, but the way this waiver is structured, you are going to see a much more systematic approach to reporting, you know, who's been contacted, where they are on the compliance scales. So that should be an improvement.
We're calling it a strategy.
And it's that strategy that Brian walked
yes.
through in today's presentation.
Yes. Okay. No other comments or questions?
My question doesn't get answered.
It was. I'm sorry, Mr. Pace. You're.
No.
So.
Question and ask them to respond to about whether water quality is
important. Ms. Olson, do you want to address this?
This is for technical staff, and the idea was: do we have any trends yet in improvements in water quality, not just on the fish parameter?
We certainly have a lot of indications on the ground of improvements in riparian conditions, and you know, we have increased riparian vegetation that's blocking solar radiation and cooling the water in certain areas, particularly priority area one that we talked about earlier. And we have some monitoring that suggests there is an initial trend towards cooling of the water. But, you know, it's kind of early yet. It takes a while to, you know, establish a long-term trend. And we've, you know, we've only been improving conditions in Area 1 for, you know, the last few years. So, you know, maybe in a couple of years we'll see a good indication that water quality is improving fairly dramatically, is the hope.
And I'll just add briefly that, you know, there are different types of monitoring. There's monitoring about what an individual landowner is doing. That's one form. And there's also trend monitoring about what's happening in a watershed. And we're very enthusiastic and hopeful that the clam tap and clam bump, it will help us in that regard. And that effort is ongoing.
Thank you for that. Okay, back to us. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair. I would give you a motion to, this is 83, correct?
Yes.
To adopt order R1-2012-0083, the Shasta River TMDL conditional waiver of waste discharge.
I'll second that.
Before we go to vote on that, I would like to offer an amendment that staff then, within the next 6 months, posts for a fact sheet memorializing this approach so it's not just a PowerPoint, and that this information becomes a public document on our webpage. I'm not talking about something you have to come back to approve with board. It becomes a dissemination of information, because what we have now is we have a original TMDL, we have the action plan that goes with it. We have a waiver that ran 5 years, and now we have a re-upped waiver with an approach and strategy that was talked about today, which I very much like. I would just like to see a fact sheet of some kind that the regulated community, that we, and that others working in this watershed could then be on the same page as this goes, and to not exceed 6 months from today to have that up on the web page. I'd like to take a look at it. It's not an approval document or anything like that, but I'd like to request that formally.
If I could make a recommendation that your request can be a formal request, but it not be in the form of a motion that modifies this order.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
Thank you.
We'll move forward with the order adoption, and then he can give direction to staff.
Okay, I just didn't want to leave it out and have it be adopted and have something come back and say it was done. So, okay, so then... Let me walk that back. So then we have a motion and a second to adopt the waiver as it stands. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Then my direction to you, please, is to post this information on for public dissemination to participating parties, landowners, and our website to memorialize the documentation that we talked about today with approach and strategy. And as this is developed, come back and talk to us on a yearly basis at a minimum to come back and tell us how this goes. Okay, I'd like to propose that we take a 15-minute break. We got to clean out our hotel rooms because we're past 12 and we got to gather stuff because we're a half hour late in doing so. We'll gather back here at 12:45 and take up the Scott.
Timber harvest plans where you have a consultant come in and write a 100-page document. If you're going to do this, we used to have some RangeMax software. Years ago, I was executive director of the Farm Bureau. We had some software that had been developed and was housed in the Farm Advisors that was a fill-in-the-blank type thing for water quality. That might be something that might be acceptable. We also had the NRCS came out, and they worked, and the Farm Advisor came out and helped people develop ranch plans for addressing things like water quality. Mm-hmm. If we can get some kind of standardized process that's relatively painless, where they don't have to pay $20,000 to a consultant to complete this, or where it's a workshop, a one-day workshop, that or a two-day workshop maybe at the max, where they get these plans done. Something that's easy for them to do, that they're not spending hours and hours and hours. There's a video that was produced by one of my ranchers, and she has all of these 100-page regulations sitting on her table and says, we have to comply with all of these. We all have to take, you know, our evenings are spent reading these things and trying to figure out how do we respond to this. And so making it easy is an important part of that. The other orders, bullet number 1, 2, and 3 require active management of riparian areas. Well, not everybody actively manages those. So you're requiring, you're not asking people to avoid, minimize, and mitigate. You're asking people to take an action that they might not ordinarily take, which is a new standard for regulation in my my mind. Also, the grazing of riparian areas, we have some noxious weeds that are managed by grazing, and you have to allow for things like that where it's a season where you come in and you can graze them at a certain period of time, then they don't pod out and spread up and down the river. So there has to be some flexibility there. There are water rights for livestock that if they're not used, you lose them. So there has to be some way. Right now we have hardened areas where the livestock can go in the river and get that water. So there has to be some kind of accommodation for that. There's a requirement that you prevent excess irrigation water from reaching surface waters. Well, right now, tailwater is an adjudicated commodity or entity in the Scott River adjudication. So it belongs to somebody else. So if you're taking their tailwater, you're taking their water, right? So that's a complexity of the law that's going to have to be worked out. And certainly you don't capture and reuse and add to your own water right from what you're diverting and then add more, and then the next guy down the line doesn't have his water right. So there's some stuff that has to be done there, and the Siskiyou County Superior Court has jurisdiction over that. Then there's a specter of future fees whenever you have a regulatory program, the fees generally follow. And so all of a sudden you get a bill for fees, and we're being, I think we're suffering from regulatory fatigue and from fee fatigue. Our water master bills have gone up, the Department of Fish and Game permits have gone up, and as I said, these are very small operators. They are struggling to survive. So if we can do this, and then I appreciate what you're trying to do here, but, you know, there has to be some other options, particularly for these larger landowners. It may be that they and their attorneys decide this is not the way they want to go. They want to go the permit, and they want you to show that there's proximate cause, that they're doing something wrong, and then have to get a permit. So... and I look forward, I understand we're going to have a session for coordination with the board, and I thank you so much for that. We also have the Flood Control and Water Conservation District, which happens to have the same board members as the Board of Supervisors. That was created by the Klamath Compact, which is between the state of California and Oregon and approved by Congress, and is also in the water law. And it does have some overlapping jurisdiction with water quality and flows with this board. So I'm looking forward to exploring what we can do in that regard, to some dialogue there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marcia. Hey, one thing, just, you know, from the standpoint of when I said everybody was in, I really meant that as, you know, we talked today, staff presented a process which is more intentional in the implementation for specific areas based on criteria. My point in, yes, there is an opt-out. You can say, I don't want to be a part of this waiver. I think that's always been in place, and then you're subject perhaps to waste discharge requirements, and that's what you just addressed. At the same time, when I say that everybody's in, I'm talking about a watershed approach. That's really what this TMDL is, and it is a community-based watershed approach that takes in the whole thing. And I did not want to leave it out that from the standpoint that the waiver is conditional, and if we're going and doing intentional work in specific areas based on some criteria, I don't want to have others. I don't want to leave an impression that there's no requirements out here, because actually there is, and that was my point. You're absolutely right about the opt-out. As far as two, I would welcome to work on an approach for a standardized approach and bring in, like you talk about, whether it be this Range Max program, NRCS, others. You know, we actually just in January adopted a dairy waiver program, and again, we're an implementing agency for that, and we had some real participation from some very important partners out there, and it made the biggest difference, and there was workshops about how to go about doing this, and in fact, if we could find that type of mechanism that could work here, I would wholly support that, and I think this board would as well, and I mean, I think that makes efficient use, that brings local expertise, it vests people into a program that they then could walk into and have a say into, and I think that's a really, really positive thing. So I thank you for those comments. I think they're very germane.
Thank you.
Mr. Massey.
Marcia, just something that you've noted and we have noted as well, the connection between fees, waivers, et cetera. And we have committed, I think every person on this board says, no, there shouldn't be a fee for this. But you need to be aware, and you are aware, that somebody's going to put a fee with it. I was looking to see if Mr. Moore is here, and I believe he's left. But the state board, for a couple of reasons. One, because the legislature's put it on them. And number two, because other areas notice that we don't charge any kind. And I think at some point it will happen. The other thing is that if it does happen, rest assured that we don't get it, which is, I think, the hard part of it. You know, I don't mind if it was here in the region, but it's not. It goes to Sacramento, which is the second largest black hole in America.
Thank you, Marcia. Crystal Bowman. Sorry to put you off there for a while, Crystal. Thanks you for being patient.
That's all right. I need to read off here because I've been making so many comments. I don't want to miss anything. Anyway, my name is Crystal Bowman. I'm the Water Resources Coordinator for the Karuk Tribe. And I wanted to start by saying that in reviewing the new Scott waiver, there's pretty minimal differences between the old and the new. And that really it's going to come down to the implementation strategy taken by staff if water quality improvements are to be achieved. And the tribe doesn't feel that the recently expired waiver was very effective. It appeared that from 2005 to 2011, that the strategy was focused more on investigating and responding to complaints instead of working with landowners to restore impairments. We support the one-on-one approach with the largest parcels adjacent to the river, but feel the approach's effectiveness is going to rely on what the Regional Water Board staff does day-to-day, how hard they pressure the cleanup, how much assistance is provided to facilitate improvement, and also that appropriate actions are taken if one of these 15 landowners does not wish to participate. However, this is not going to be enough, and the tribe feels that the TMDL implementation plan should have required the groundwater study plan to be not just developed but also implemented, and in a timely manner with deadlines and results used to develop and implement a groundwater management plan in the Scott Valley. The impact of cold groundwater inflow on surface flow temps is critical to the Scott, and understanding that is going to lead to prioritizing restoration efforts in the most appropriate way. And by doing all of that, we feel that enough fish habitat will be achieved and that we can achieve the goals of the Karuk tribe, that is to provide for the salmon habitat that's important for spawning for coho, chinook, and steelhead in Scott and Shasta. Thanks.
Thank you, Crystal. Elaine Dalcini. We got a pass. Liz Bowen.
Howdy, Liz Bowen, landowner in Scott Valley, and also Vice President of Scott Valley Protect Our Water. I've been involved with the TAG meetings with Brian for many years, and poor Brian, I always pick on him. he puts up with it. It really goes back to what, after we gave them information about the intermittent streams and photos of the land, of the river, of the trees, of how things used to be. More photos have recently been coming forward as to how the area looked 100 years ago. And our real frustration at that point was that we were told that was anecdotal information. It wasn't real. And I do appreciate the comments here today, because the real aspect is that what is truly practical? First of all, we believe what is out there with the temperature of the river has been found scientifically to be natural. There's cold refugia coming up. Anybody who swam in the river knows where there's cold spots and there's warm spots. And we feel that we're still being, these problems are being put onto us to fix things that are still very natural. It is nature. And some of the things we really can't fix, and we can't fix our neighbor's property. But to go back to what was said earlier by both of our supervisors, a tremendous amount of enhancements and fixes have been done. And there really isn't much left, and it's not the low-hanging fruit. It's the fact that this is the way nature is. The cattle don't go in the river. We have learned that we do need them to be in the critical habitat areas. There's a tremendous amount of trees along the river. A lot of them, yes, are not right close smack dab on the river because we get floods. And our river in the south end goes this way, and it takes out trees and willows and cottonwoods and the bank as well, so we've worked on that. Also, I will say once again, this is not Karuk territory. I'm sure you know that they ended their territory was down on the other side of Happy Camp. This is the Shasta Nation. It was a huge nation. Yes, they do not have a treaty with the United States. Karuk tribe used their Treaty R when they got their federal recognition in 1980. And we do not appreciate the Karuks thinking that they this is their area and this was their fish. This was Shasta territory, and there is a lot of fish. 15,000 fish coming back to Shasta River is amazing. We had over 4,000 come back on the Scott last year. So much has been done, and it is frustrating that it's never enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. I have one last speaker card, Felicia Pez.
Felicia Pace, representing the Sierra Club North Group and Redwood Chapter. I moved to the Scott Valley in 1975. The Bank of America and I still own a house there. Moved to the coast about 10 years ago, down onto the Yurok Reservation near the mouth. There has been no notification on the Scott ever. So, you know, the notification issue that I raised in the Shasta, there has been one letter to the Shasta. If you guys feel it's legally sufficient, even with the change, then, you know, I hope you're correct. But there's never been any on the Shasta. When we did the workshop on this waiver, the original workshop at Fort Jones, they were plowing Moffat Creek right next to the, right up to the creek bank. And they still are, okay? They've never been notified that they have any requirements. So I raise that issue again. How many letters is it? There's 5,000 people roughly in the Scott Valley. Maybe 10% of them are agricultural landowners or landowners that have river, let's say 500 letters. We can't send them out? Why not? I think, you know, I go back to my Siskiyou County judge, equal protection, and I think, you know, we need to have maintenance of effort form that people sign once a year and send in. Just a form that they're maintaining their effort, that they know they're responsible, and that they're maintaining their effort. Ranch and tailwater plans, if they're relied upon, then they should be public information. There's no trade secrets in there. Grazing riparian for weeds, where's the evidence? The cattle, you know, the mechanical damage that prepares, that disturbs the soil. And I can take you out to the Scott right now. I got the slides too, you know, but that I could show you of areas that have been grazed. The riparian has been grazed year after year, covered with noxious weeds, type, you know, number one weeds, noxious weeds agricultural designation. So, you know, I'd like to see some evidence that this grazing is needed in the riparian areas. I think the guys, you know, some of them are friends of mine. I know a lot of them. And, you know, they want to utilize that forage. That's understandable. But I think it does spread noxious weeds.
Inadequate public education. You know, we're relying a lot on public education, and yet the whole water board, is there an educator anywhere in the water board? I have suggested when we originally did these that if we're going to rely on public education, we need a public educator, either a contract or somebody on staff, because I think we need education in lots of these areas if we're going to rely on these voluntary, you know, programs and stuff like that. And I think we should, you know, if people are willing to do stuff voluntarily. But that requires education. And we don't have a program there. We have lip service. You know, the staff, I got to go back to this complaint stuff because I made a major complaint this winter. I think that's what you heard about at the workshop, okay? It was because somebody went in the middle of the winter and bulldozed half a mile of Patterson Creek, burned and cut all the riparian vegetation and burned it. It was a moonscape, okay? Turns out Fish and Game had given permits to hundreds of people to do this kinds of stuff. And the material was supposed to not be sold. We don't know whether it was sold or not. So, you know, staff, I take it personally. You know, I don't make frivolous complaints. And staff sat up here and said, you know, most of the complaints are frivolous. They don't mean anything. You know, and the input you got was directed at my complaint. There's been a lot of threats and intimidation around it and all that kind of stuff. So I don't, you know, I'm upset. I'm really personally upset. And I'm wondering, where's the public interest? You know, I hear people talking to the agricultural, talking to the timber. We had John Corbett sit there. You know, he is making land deals for his employer with Green Diamond. And he sits there while we're doing Green Diamond and then he leaves? He should have left during Green Diamond and come back for the rest of the stuff. You know, I think that was very inappropriate.
Felicia, you got to wrap it up.
Okay, I will wrap it up. Jim Denny, the grandson of pioneers, long dead now, you know, wrote an article in the 1970s. I'd be happy, if you give me a note, I'll be happy to send it to you or send it through staff. It's called The Death of a Lady, and in the 1970s, he talked about what the Scott River was like when he was a kid. And then he said, it's dying, it's being killed. It's gone downhill a lot since then, I can tell you, because I came in the mid-70s. And or you could look at the data. So, you know, we gotta get serious here. I think the bottom line with the Scott is we need to have notification or else you're on shaky legal grounds. You got to have notification, and you need to have public education across the board if we're going to rely on these kind of programs that we are. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Olson, may I ask you about our obligation and about what we have done to date with notification? Because when we talk of what notification is not, that's not the notification to me to come to pick up the phone and come to somebody's ranch or staff to do so. This is notification of a program. This is a programmatic obligation of landowners in this watershed that a program is in place and that there are obligations to do things. Can you at least add something to or inform me about this? TMDL is 5 years in. This is not a new program. Everything that we have done has been publicly notified. Can you maybe add some information to what has been the process of public disclosure and notification of this program in the past and up to today?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's extensive procedural requirements. First, for the promulgation of the TMDL, which was noticed pursuant to a rulemaking when we do basin plan amendments. So that's noticed very broadly. Now, this is more like a general permit, but it also has broad noticing requirements. Somebody doesn't choose to show up. It doesn't mean we didn't issue the notice and that it's not binding on the community. So, I think we're in good standing as far as the notice requirements for these two waivers.
Everything that we have done to date, I would imagine, and I'm just guessing here and driving fast and taking chances, is that everything we have done from TMDL day one to today has been publicly notified.
Yeah, probably above and beyond the requirements.
To our obligation.
And I'll also add, you know, I mean, the Water Code, you know, the Water Code provides the authority for the EO to request a ranch plan just even without a TMDL or the general waiver. It's pursuant to Water Code Section 13267. So if you wanted to restart the clock on notice, you could as well, but I don't think we have a problem with the noticing.
Well, and in the vein, too, of what Felice Pace said, and actually what Marcia Armstrong said as well, as far as having information out here, I believe it was Marcia. I don't want to incorrectly attribute that to her, but that, you know, this public education part of things, and to me, that does get to notification. That is, in fact, why when we adopted the Shasta, that when we took on the Shasta, that's why I want this information to be posted in the form of a fact sheet of what we're doing today. I realize that in coming up here many times now that we often don't capture everybody in a room to talk to us, that people do have busy lives, that they're not here, and that's okay. I don't have that requirement. That's their option to be here, but I would like to, on the backside, my point in asking for Andy to put together that type of documentation is exactly for that notification or educational purposes out there. That's where I was coming from, and I think that goes further than our legal obligation for public noticing of a program implementation and adoption.
Correct. We need to distinguish noticing as far as our legal obligations and outreach. Now, Andy didn't like my idea of him going and setting up a booth at the fair, but I still think it's a great idea, or the Bluegrass Festival, or any other number of ways to catch the community where they are.
Well, you get them on a dump tank, idea, you'll probably have like a whole lot of
Well, I raised the topic of a dump tank.
I will go to the fair.
You will go to the fair. Okay. I think it's a great idea, but that would be outreach, not noticing necessarily.
Okay, thank you for that, because I do take it, you know, I realize not everybody's here. I do realize that there's landowners in certain segments of this population and watersheds and communities out here that no matter how many times we post it or no matter how many times we notice this on public websites or however we do it, that we're just not going to have participation in an active sense, but I want to give the opportunity to have the participation to explore and to educate either yourself individually or ourselves collectively about what is our obligations here of this program and in a greater sense. So, Mr. McFadden, can I ask you to come back up? Mr. Hales.
Brian, I like the points that Supervisor Armstrong brought up, and one that struck me was that her comment about the bullets that are listed out here in the order. You know, and her point about certain things, certain activities that folks aren't engaging in, but potentially these could force them to manage parts of their land that they typically don't do. For example, to do range management plans or riparian management plans or riparian zone management, if I'm getting that right. But my point is that with this bulleted list, what I see here is it says that these are just guidance items.
Correct.
These aren't thou shalt do all of these things listed here. These are just example guidance. These are things that you could be doing if we find necessary on your land.
It even goes beyond that. Supervisor Armstrong characterized this as requiring active management, and this was actually, it pertains to a comment that we received, and we have a response that addresses this, that we don't see it the same way, and respectfully disagree with Supervisor Armstrong that this requires active management. Passive management, you know, leaving an area alone is still managing in a manner that, for instance, allows natural establishment and persistence of native vegetation. That's passive. You just let the trees grow. Our point here is that whatever management occurs there isn't interfering with that process. But it doesn't mean that somebody actually has to go and do something if what's going on there, the natural succession is unimpeded and it's working.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that partly just to hear you say that, maybe for Supervisor Armstrong to hear you say that, gives some acknowledgement that you are aware of her concern, and there was obviously a response to comment there too, but that's, you know, you have that on your mind when you're looking at these types of things and clearly trying to engage and work proactively with a landowner to identify and potentially come up with solutions to areas you see that may need some requirements. Okay.
Ms. Harris?
In reading these and recognizing that they're guidelines, there was commentary regarding kind of using the rivers as their water source and the hardened pathways that go down in there, and And in reading these guidelines, I don't see that they preclude anyone from grazing the riparian area or even allowing livestock access as long as those activities do not create a discharge or do not create a pollutant in some form. So I think that's important to recognize also that we're not saying you can't do that. We're just saying that if you do it, it needs to not have a negative impact.
That's correct. Okay. And I know you're perfectly aware that NRCS has defined many practices that achieve that, basically, you know, like the crossing lanes or the access to water. You know, there's all that's been described. How you do that and still protect water quality, that information's out there. It's not that's not a research
not a
topic.
Yeah. Oh, one more thing. And the other thing is, I remember working with a landowner once who was just furious that I would suggest that he provided off-site water on a particular spot, and his grandpa had done it the way he was doing it, and there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. And I said, fine, so when your kids get sick, I hope you give them sulfur pills, because antibiotics by no means are necessary. I mean, your grandpa probably took sulfur pills to get rid of it, so have at it. And of course he frowned at me across the truck, and fortunately we were pretty good friends, so it was a good give and take. But my point, later on he did do the off-site watering, and he said, don't tell anybody, but you were right. And I've just told all of you, but you don't know who he is, so we're game.
Yeah, you still have an out of him.
And he's a pretty cantankerous guy. I gave him low-stress livestock handling materials once, and he told me he was going to use them to start his fire on the summit. So anyway, we had all kinds of good back and forth. But one of the things that he came to, and I think that most of the people in this room are either coming to or arriving at, is that in this day and age, you can't not have a plan. It doesn't matter if it's a two-pager and you've taken a couple shots and you've established, you know, what your fields look like, and now you're put in a couple new fences or you're managing a little bit different. A plan is a living document. It doesn't mean I'm going to do it this way for the rest of my life and that I expect my kids to do it this way for the rest of their lives. It just means that I have acknowledged that I might need to make these adjustments inside my management plan, or that I recognize that, you know, I am getting more and more weeds over here. I need to tweak some grazing, you know, use different tools or what have you. And I just think that it's a good idea to have a plan. And it always makes me feel bad when regulatory agencies or when regulation forces someone into making that plan. But at sometimes that's just kind of the mechanism that shoves the rock over the hill. But I would encourage you to make a plan, you know, of your own accord. Be proactive and make those grazing management plans. And it's such a better feeling when someone comes to you and says, I'm concerned about this, and you can say, yeah, so was I. Here's my plan. These are the pictures that we've already started taking. And then it's taken care of. And you're not in that position where you have to feel defensive of the way you do things. And I just would encourage everyone to do it on their own. And then if it fits into what we're asking you to provide us with, great, it's already done.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree. And our office, you know, staff do as well. And reflective of that is the fact that we've contracted with the Shasta Valley RCD to assist landowners in the development of ranch plans. That's in place, and we're continuing it. And we have a similar contract in the works now. Should be completed within just a number of weeks.
Good.
To do the same thing in Scott Valley in partnership with the Siskiyou Resource Conservation District. I didn't present it as part of this presentation, and Andy didn't either, because it's not part and parcel to the waiver program. It certainly, there's overlap. Right. But we agree that having those plans are a great tool for landowners. And for instance, we're not limiting in the scope of work or in the contract with these RCDs that plans only be developed for people who we request a plan from. You know, it's helpful in all aspects, and so that's the road we're going down, is helping people develop those plans, which I think also addresses Supervisor Armstrong's concern about that. You know, she was right to point out that, that there has been a lot of tools like that that have been developed with the NRCS and with the Farm Bureau and Cattlemen's Association, and we intend to utilize those tools. And I believe it also addresses some of what Felice was saying about education. Mm-hmm. And in the contract with the Siskiyou RCD, draft scope of work, that we've put in front of their board, and they've agreed, you know, it was voted on and passed unanimously. A part of that is some workshops and landowner education.
I think I see an opportunity, and I between all that theme, Brian, between that type of alignment of funding and expertise out there from third parties, the suggestion from Supervisor Armstrong to have a, you know, maybe these management plan and a standardized approach out there done by perhaps a third party, and actually what Felice Pace recommended, which was education. And I think you could kind of get all those birds with one stone, perhaps, at least part way, if not all the way, by that type of approach. And to me, that seems like an opportunity.
Agreed. Yeah.
Can I ask, I recall, in fact, the last workshop, not this one that just happened in early August, but the one that happened last spring, or spring before last, actually, in Scott River, Dr. Thomas Harder presented the groundwater management, or the groundwater study, excuse me. And I seem to recall, and I may be wrong on this, that the groundwater management planning is a local, there was issue with that as far as how that goes. And can I just ask, I don't recall the details of that. I know the Siskiyou County Supervisors, I believe, were part of that, because I remember Supervisor Armstrong commenting on that previously. But can you just shed a little bit of light about where that's at here?
Sure. excuse me. The county has established a groundwater advisory committee for Scott Valley, and I believe it's their intention to continue that in other basins, but I will let Supervisor Armstrong confirm that if that's the case. But in the Scott Valley, we have the Scott Groundwater Advisory Committee that was established by the county and has been in place and meeting and working with Dr. Harder for some time now. It's, I think, going very well in terms of information flow. The committee, the advisory committee, is largely made up of water users, and they have experience, obviously, in how the water is used in Scott Valley, and they've fed information to Dr. Harder and his team to improve the performance of the model. But they've gone beyond that, too, and are thinking about solutions to the water quantity issues. And I have heard them talking about the possibility of developing a management plan, a groundwater management plan. I think that that's probably going to happen. And I think that of all the different elements of the TMDL, the groundwater piece is moving forward the best. We're going to have a real solid tool here in the near future to evaluate how water use is translating to flows and what possible solutions might be put in place to address that.
And I seem to recall, too, and maybe it was at that spring workshop a year and a half or so ago that, you know, and I meant to ask you about it, Liz, because I believe that we had either a sidebar or we had talked about there was some things like vegetation management on some of the hills. There was talk about winter irrigation during kind of that fallow time to just artificially recharge that aquifer off a high flow using water, you know, yeah, using irrigation, flood irrigation practices to get storativity that would then discharge later. And there were some really good ideas on some of that kind of stuff that were kind of kicked around. And, you know, to have that kind of idea base from land users out here that have used that water for years and have watched that ditch go and that field absorb that water and whatnot and discharge, then and you're swimming the river as a kid, I'm darn sure you know where those cold spots are, that, you know, that those are tools. Those are real tangible tools to use out there. And that groundwater management end of that thing, however that gets done, whether that, and I could, you know, foresee that, you know, out of that study comes a plan, or maybe that, maybe it doesn't, but that could also be a pretty important tool, I think, in looking at, you know, that equation of groundwater use out here as it affects flow and cold water recharge and all that phreatic water and everything that goes on out there. So that's all good. Any other comments or questions for Brent?
Chair, would you like to come?
Can I ask you to come up here, Marshall? You've got a speaker card in. Let's just have you back up because we went down that path and it kind of ties us all together here on what we're talking about.
Can you tell us the timeline?
The voluntary groundwater management plan is currently being worked on by the committee and is anticipated to go to our county council within the month. But since we have some issues with county council right now, it might be a little longer. We're anticipating it'll probably come before the Board of Supervisors for initial consideration probably in December or January.
Well, and it's interesting, Marcia, because I know you were at that workshop, as was I, a year and a half ago, and I recall Thomas Harder describing basically a cup, you know, which is that basin, right, with all of its, you know, aggregate materials, and that it does recharge. It has a hydrogeologic function that then charges and discharges through that cycle and year, and it's quite interesting. It was a very powerful and informative tool to have like that, to have somebody of his, you know, stature and bring the UC into it as a third party then, and then to have county step in, by the way, I think is very good.
Right, and it's there's no indication that it's overdraft as a watershed. It's just the issue, as we talked about, someone mentioned earlier, there's historic, we have intermittent streams, and it's no-fed system, so there's nothing coming into the system. So it's a matter of timing. And what we can do to keep the water in, you know, treat it more like a sponge, where the water is retained in the watershed and then delivers out during the summer, whether that's artificially done through holding ponds or whatever. But looking at adaptive management and discrete projects and trying to figure out how we do that so that we can test out some of these areas of what our intuition tells us probably will help the system in that regard deliver. We're having like beavers right now are establishing on Scott River, and we're looking at what's happening with that, and is that it's making deeper ponds in some areas, but then it's stopping the flow. So, you know, we have to look at, you know, with our new pivot wheels, what is that doing? So it's that idea of discreetly isolating what we're doing management-wise and then monitoring what the results are to see if it's replicatable or what the result is.
Can you tell me if the beavers have a permit from the Army Corps?
Just had to do it.
I don't know, but they're eating your willows.
Hey, Marcia, thank you. I mean, I think it is a very important component of TMDL out here in flow and the larger flow component. Thank you, by the way, for the county for being a part of that. And thank you for coming up and informing us. Okay, any other questions for staff?
Nope. I just want to address one thing. I believe beavers have a categorical exemption.
Okay, that's
just
it.
Checking.
That's it.
And Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hale.
I would give you a motion then to adopt order number R1 2012-0084, Scott River, TMDL conditional waiver.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. I would like to give the same direction I gave to Mr. Baker, that I think it's important in what we have talked about today with outreach, education, and opportunity to do so is to, within 6 months of today, to post a fact sheet that memorializes the approach, much of what we have talked about before, and come back and inform us on a periodic basis, not to exceed 1 year from now, about how this goes.
Second. Certainly.
Well done, gentlemen. We're going to take a lunch break. I believe we have closed session. I think we'll be back. What time you got?
1:35.
We'll be back at 2:15. Would that work?
Yeah.
2:15. Thank you.
Good.
Good work.